Welcome, somebody who's not on the staff here regularly, but Rabbi Reichman is a muslach of the yeshiva. He's also an MD who's an emergency room doctor at Montefiore, and also professor of medicine at Einstein. So with all those hats, we asked him to give a shiur on a little bit about the medical aspect and also on the halachic aspects of brain death, which is a very significant Shaila is related to organ donation. B'chavad Rav, thank you, Rabbi Dr. Rav.
My pleasure, my schus. Thank you so much, Rabbi Orlin. It's always great to spend time with you guys. Just for my knowledge, I always ask, what medical topics have you guys covered so far? They covered anything? Nothing yet?
No.
Fasting?
We have genetics coming up. Yeah.
Genetics, great. Who's speaking on the genetics?
Dr. Levine, Zalman Levine.
Oh, great, perfect, excellent. He's phenomenal, Zalman. Okay, very good. So I guess we're starting at the end of life. We should really go the other way around. We should do genetics first and then death. But I guess we'll start from death and work our way backwards. Any of you guys in Hatzalah? Or ever worked in Hatzalah? So here's the fascinating question. You get called on Hatzalah call. You come to somebody's house, and Rahman al-Itzlan, the person had a heart attack. He's not breathing. He has no pulse. How do you determine if this person is alive or not? Right? Any ideas? You don't have to be doctors to answer this question. How can you figure out if somebody is alive or not?
Pulse.
Pulse. Good.
They're breathing.
Breathing. Okay. Those are two very good things. I'm sorry?
Movement
of any type, right? So if he sits up and looks at you, you know, and starts walking across the room, the odds are pretty small that the person's actually not alive. So this may seem like a ridiculous kind of question, but in the age that we live in and the topic we're going to discuss, you'll see it's not such a ridiculous question. And in fact, for thousands of years, there really wasn't much debate as to how death was diagnosed, although, as we shall see, there was a question about the accuracy of the diagnosis. But for thousands of years, you know, if your heart stopped, you stopped breathing, and we'll see the different approaches that people had. You knew pretty much that the person was likely. Did you have a question?
No.
You knew pretty much that the person was likely not alive. You may want to confirm it. You may want to watch. You may not make sure there's no misdiagnosis. But what has evolved in the last few decades, in the end of the 20th century, beginning of the 21st century, is a new and alternate definition of death, and that is called brain death. And that's what we're going to be discussing today. Just for my knowledge, how many people here are even familiar with the concept of brain death? You guys are familiar with the concept of brain death. Very good. Okay, so we'll give you your final exams after today's class about the definition of brain death. So just to give you an idea, the brain death in the halachic literature is a few decades old, and we'll be discussing that literature today. But just to give you an idea of the fact that it is quite a current topic and remains a still controversial topic about the definition of death, I show you these two news items from this past year. So here you have on the top, what did you just do here? There's no... still alive after being pronounced dead, New York hospital slapped with lawsuit asking for retraction of Jewish man's death certificate. So this is a case that happened a few miles from where we are at a major New York hospital. There was a person that was diagnosed as being brain dead. The hospital wrote a death certificate for the person and said that he was dead and declared him such. The family said, "We are Jews, Orthodox Jews, and according to our particular religious beliefs, we do not believe this person is legally dead." So they said, "Okay, so if you want to transfer him, you can transfer him." So they transferred him to another hospital in the New York area, and as it turned out a few weeks later, his heart stopped beating as well, and he sustained both cardiac as well as brain death. And as these things often play out, it turns out that finances is what tips things off into the court system. So the family got a bill for care from the second hospital for like many, many thousands of dollars. And they said, what was the insurance company's? And they said, why doesn't the insurance company pay for this? So the insurance company says, why should I pay for this? There was a death certificate from 3 weeks ago I usually don't pay for care for dead patients. So this is still playing out in the courts, by the way, and we'll understand more as we go through this year what exactly the issue is and why this is an issue even in the 21st century. And an almost parallel case happened in Canada, the second entry. Orthodox Jewish family wants brain-dead son's death certificate rescinded because faith won't accept he is deceased. Doctors say Shalom Wanunu is brain-dead and has been for over a month after suffering tragically a cardiac arrest. His family, devout Orthodox Jews, do not believe that neurological demise equals death, insist the 25-year-old is still alive. And this is really our discussion. What is brain death? Is it possible that someone could be brain dead yet still be alive, according to some, and not according to others? So clarity is what we are seeking here in our discussion today about this definition of death. In my presentations are informal, so don't hesitate to ask me at any time to clarify things, clarify medical issues, clarify halachic issues. If there's something you don't think I'm saying, don't hesitate to ask me. And finally, this is from the February 5th issue, 2018. What does it mean to die? This is another case, very fascinating article. And if you guys got extra time, which I know you don't, it is really a remarkable article about challenging what it means to be alive, what it means to be dead. This is a case of a young girl, a 15-year-old girl, who underwent surgery for tonsil removal. Relatively straightforward surgery. Unfortunately, she had post-surgical complications. She sustained a cardiac arrest, was without oxygen for a fairly prolonged period of time, and was diagnosed as being brain dead. This was in California. This is not an Orthodox Jewish family. The hospital declared her dead, because brain death, as we shall see, is a legal definition of death, and almost all states in this country only accept... can accept either brain death or cardiac death as legal death, and you can't fight that. If they say the patient's brain dead, they can disconnect everything. They can declare the patient dead. The family fought this. In California, there is no law saying they can fight brain death, so they actually transferred the patient to New Jersey. And the patient is still in a bed in New Jersey. Heart is still beating. And there's ongoing discussions about whether that initial diagnosis of brain death was an accurate definition. How is it possible for somebody to be sustained for, I think it's years already, with this diagnosis of brain death? Does that force us to reevaluate this new definition of brain death in light of this fact? I actually was peripherally involved in this case. There was a Jewish surgeon who was asked to perform a procedure on this girl in Oakland in order to facilitate her being transferred to New York. And he called me up and he said, am I allowed to do a procedure on this girl? Is she halachically dead? Is she halachically alive? Is it nivola meis? Those are the kinds of issues that had come up. But that's what we're going to be discussing today. So our objective today is the following. Descriptions of death in Tanakh. We're going to start with Tanakh, work our way up into the 20th and 21st century. Historical precedent for the present brain death debate. Third, the medical diagnosis of brain death, which we're not going to belabor, just give you general ideas of how indeed one could determine today at a hospital bed that a patient does have this particular diagnosis. And four, once you are determined to have this particular diagnosis, what do the posts can say about it? Is such a person with this new diagnosis of brain dead considered halachically dead? If yes, what are the halachic ramifications? If no, what are the halachic ramifications? So we'll start with descriptions of death in Tanakh. Now, like everything, we always look to our first makor is the Chumash in terms of makoros for contemporary issues, which makes, by the way, medical halacha uniquely challenging in terms of halachic discussions. You know, people discuss many halachic issues, Hilchos Shabbos, Kashrus. I mean, there are many modern challenges for those two as well. But in the medical world, there are many medical advances for which there really isn't clear precedent in the halachic literature in pre-modern times. And the definition of death, especially brain death, as we shall see, is quite challenging in terms of finding halachic precedent. So we always look to the Chumash. So in cases like abortion, for example, there are sugyas which derive from Chumash and Rishonim and Achronim that talk about talk about abortion. But is there any definition in Tanakh about death? So the answer is, do people die in Tanakh? Of course, many people die in Tanakh. But there is no statement in Chumash that says this is the definition of what constitutes death. But we do have people that do die. Just to share with you interesting historical observations in some of these makoros. So here's the story of Yaakov, and it's a fascinating shot here that I'm going to share with you by the Ramban. It says, this is the context, by Ya'alu Mitzrayim, by Yehoretz Kanan El Yaakov Avihem. The scenario is the following. The sons of Yaakov are coming to Yaakov to inform him that his long-lost son is actually still alive, whom he had thought had died many years ago. Yagidu lo limor od Yosef chai, v'chiyu Moshe b'chol eretz Mitzrayim. And then it says, v'yafog libo ki lo ha'emin lahem. It says, v'yafog libo, something happened to his heart. And then it says, they prodded him and spoke to him, and they showed them the agalos, and you're all famous with the Rashi, the Yosek, and the agalos, they were learning Egla Rufa. And then the story ends, v'tachi ruach Yaakov avihem. And you're all famous with the Medrash, the Rashi quotes, v'tachi ruach avihem is that his ruach HaKodesh was lost when he thought that Yosef had died, his ruach HaKodesh was restored. But the Ramban has a different explanation. And the Ramban, by the way, was a physician. So you know probably that his rough contemporary, the Rambam, was also a physician. We actually have many of the works that the Rambam wrote in medicine, which you probably are not aware of. If you go to your local Sforim store, in addition to the Halacha section, where you'll find the Mishneh Torah, you can go to the philosophy section, you'll see the Rambam's work on the philosophy. You go to the medical section, you'll see the translation of the Rambam's medical works. Rambam's medical works are available. They're available. He wrote them in Arabic. They're available in English. They're available in Hebrew. He wrote on asthma. He wrote on hemorrhoids. He wrote on health preservation. And many people are even looking at these to try and extract medical lessons for today from the things that the Rambam wrote about. But the Ramban was also a physician. We don't have any of the works that the Ramban wrote. We don't know if he wrote anything on medicine. But how do we know he was a physician? We know he was a physician from his Talmud, from the Rashba. Rashba quotes in his Tshuvos, Taf Yud Gimel, and in others as well, that he had a shaila about some medical issue using a medallion of a lion to treat a particular disease, a kidney disease, and there was a kashash, it might be Darki Amori. So the Rashba says, well, I know it's not Darki Amori because my Rebbe the Ramban used to use that to treat kidney disease. So if my Rebbe the Ramban was using it in his medical practice, I don't think you have to worry about it. I think you're safe. As we know, the Ramban was a physician. By the way, apropos the talk on genetics by Rabbi Dr. Zalman Levin, the Ramban also treated non-Jewish women for fertility problems. And people called him to task about you're not allowed to be moli goyim. So that's another story. I'll let Zalman talk about that. So what is Ramban right here? Just briefly to share with you an interesting historical concept. The Gam Zeva Yafag Libo, Sheniz Batel Libo Paskoy Nishima So. We're talking about definition of death. His Batel Libo, his heart became bottle, stopped, Upaskoy Nishima So, and his breathing ceased. So heart and breathing. And he says he fainted. That's what happens by Yafag Libo. It says his heart stopped. Why does his heart stop? He said, because he was surprised at the fact that his son had been alive when he thought his son had been dead for so many years. So he passed out. And he says, this is known in physiology. The heart expands. Translation? The physiology of the understanding of the heart and the relationship to the lungs in the Middle Ages was as follows. They believed that the heart was the center of the heat of the body. And they have to explain, this is also, you have to understand everything in history. It's a very important lesson when you're doing medical sources in times of the pre-modern times. You have to understand what they understood of medicine at that particular time. So at that time, they understood the following. How do you know that your temperature, why is it that the temperature of the body is 98.6 degrees and this room is 68 or 70 degrees? How can our body maintain a temperature above our environment? So we know from today it's the mitochondria, chemical reactions, ATP, from your basic biochemistry. But they didn't know that. They didn't understand those things in the Middle Ages. So they assumed that the heart was the source of all the heat, akin to a house where the source of the heat was a fireplace. And they thought that there was literally a flame that burned inside the heart that kept the body at a certain temperature. And if you breathed in, breathing in was essential to maintain the flames of the heart, just like a bellows is essential for maintaining the flames in your fireplace. And if you breathed in not enough, the heat would raise high and you'd have a fever. If you breathed in too much, it would blow out the flames and you would pass out and possibly die. So that's the way the Ramban's explaining by Yafa Blibo, is his heart expanded because he was so surprised, it became cool, and he passed out. And then they prodded him and they woke him up. And the, what does it mean? This is Batchi Roch Yaakov Avihem. So according to the Ramban, Batchi Roch Yaakov Avihem means literally, not figuratively, and not his Ruach HaKodesh, that literally he was almost dying, and they resuscitated him. They successfully resuscitated him. Batchi Ruach Yaakov, his breath was restored to him, and he became alive again. That's the way the Ramban, that's the way the Ramban explains it. And there are other resuscitation episodes, which we'll just mention briefly. Eliyahu resuscitates the Ben HaTzarfatit. And by the way, the Rishonim there talked that the resuscitation may have been related to this so-called innate heat that I just mentioned, that the Ramban mentioned as well, which was a contemporary understanding of respiratory and cardiac physiology. Just for your reference, and obviously I'll share the slideshow with you guys. You're welcome to use all these sources at your leisure. The Radbaz asks a very interesting question about Eliyahu performing resuscitation. Eliyahu, according to some midrashim, was an incarnation of Pinchas. Pinchas was a Kohen. If Pinchas was a Kohen and Eliyahu, therefore, was a Kohen, how could he perform resuscitation on a dead person? Isn't there an Isser of Tumas Meis? So the Radbaz has some very interesting discussions about that for your reference. And there are others, I don't know why I didn't put it here, but there's other resuscitation of his Talmud, actually, was Elisha. Elisha performed a resuscitation on the Isha Shunamis. So this one you guys know because this is Haftorah. And he actually, the child, the Ben HaShunamis, the son of the Shunamis, where Elisha was staying and rewarded her by granting her a child. And he went out in the fields and he said, Roshi, Roshi, and he passed out and he died and he performed the resuscitation. And there are interesting discussions in both cases. Were these children actually dead? Were they just seemingly dead? And there's many, many details in terms of the analysis of the psukim to try and bear that out. So here we are now, moving forward beyond Tanakh into the 18th and the 19th century, into a very fascinating period which sparked a fascinating halachic discussion. And the period was in the mid-18th century, and it really began with the following. I alluded to in the beginning of our discussion that there was concern about the diagnosis or the veracity of the diagnosis of death in periods prior to our own. And this really reached its height in the mid-18th into the mid-19th century. And someone wrote this classic book in the history of medicine. Jacques Benin Winslow wrote this book called Morte Incerte Signa, which means the signs of death. And he wrote in that book, death is certain since it is inevitable, but also uncertain since its diagnosis is sometimes fallible. And what he wrote in the Latin language, but it was translated widely across the globe, and became prevalent in medical communities all across Europe, is basically that your local doctor in the mid-18th century is not very good at diagnosing death, and there's a very good chance that they may be wrong. You could possibly be buried alive. That was the gist of this book, which became disseminated very widely by a number of members of the medical community. And what resulted, well, here you have one result. So some entrepreneurs took advantage of this and created these interesting contraptions. So you have this interesting contraption here where a person would be buried underground with a pulley system that's hooked up to his toes and his nose and his hands. And the pulley system is connected to a bell tower that goes above ground. So should he wake up underground and move his fingers or his toes or his head, it would ring the bell up top. Hence the expression, saved by the bell. That is the original expression, not the boxing expression. There's a debate between the two. that this is the real Saved by the Bell. And another similar, there were patents that were requested for these kinds of things. This became translated into legislation throughout many parts of Europe, which basically said the following. Since there is widespread concern that people may be misdiagnosed as being dead, then every single person, before they are buried, has to be kept above ground for a certain number of days, and many of them determine this to be 3 days, that for 72 hours you need to be kept above ground to confirm the diagnosis of death, to make sure it was not a misdiagnosis. And this created a huge problem for the Jewish community. Why? Because according to our halacha, kavortik barenu bayom hahu, you have an obligation to perform the burial that very day. That was the halacha for millennia. And the question is, should this halacha change based on the contemporary medical discussion that maybe these people that we're burying are in fact still alive? And this basically created a major debate within the Jewish community. This, as I alluded to before, is the precursor to the 20th and 21st century brain death debate. This was the first time in history where Rabbanim were forced to confront the definition of death in the mid-1700s and through the 1800s. And every major posek of that generation weighed in on this, on this shaila. This was like the brain death debate of the earlier centuries. And there was Rabbi Yaakov Emden and Moses Mendelssohn were two of the major players. Rabbi Yaakov Emden was clearly the great posek. Moses Mendelssohn, he was more the person who was able to intercede with the king because of his facility with language and as being a more presentable person. So they sent Moses Mendelssohn in Germany to be the one to intercede on behalf of the Jewish community to say that the Jews need an exemption to this law, and that we will do whatever it takes in order to get an exemption to this law. And in this, people are starting to document now, going to the archives, to find how each one of these small communities throughout Germany and throughout Europe, to be honest, addressed this three-day burial controversy. And Moses Mendelssohn, while he agreed with Rabbi Yaakov Emden to appeal to the king, he himself thought that maybe we should wait the 3 days. And he turned to a Mishnah in Smachos that said the following. It says, Yotzin lebeis hakvaros upokdin kol hamesim ad shloshim yom. Said it's a custom to go to the cemetery and go observe the mesim for 30 days. The ein choshim shim darkei amari, and it's not a question of darkei amari. And they quote, as an addendum, u'ma'ase shepokdu echad achar shloshim yom, that somebody was found to be alive. V'chaya esrim v'chamesh shanim v'achar kach meis. V'achar holid chamesh banim v'achar kach meis. So they actually found cases where people were still alive. They were poked him all amazing, they found places, cases that are still alive. So Moses Mendelssohn said, well, maybe out of suffix that the person should still be alive. Maybe we should not bury all these people for 3 days. That was the shaila which was on the table for the Shulchan Melachim of the Achronim to pask in these kinds of shadows. By the way, you notice, and for all of you who have been to Eretz Yisrael, you notice these burial sites, we bury underground, right? So you notice a lot of these burial sites are not underground. They're caves, and they're these areas where the mace is placed on this little shelf. They're called mkuchin. So you probably never thought about it. He goes, how come they used to bury that way? We don't bury that way today. We don't bury in mkuchin. We bury underground. So the truth is that there are shilas about how it works. What's the halachic heter for doing it? Is it connected to the ground? Do you still need some sort of afar? Do you still need some sort of dirt to be connected to the ground to be mekayim el afar tashuv? But many people were buried this way as a temporary burial. So, for example, if somebody died in a far off land, not where their family cemetery was, they would actually bury them in one of these kuchin until the body desiccated and it was just bones. Then they would take those bones, put them in a bone box, which was called an ossuary. I don't know if you guys are familiar with biblical archaeology at all, but the ossuary is a box, a stone box about this big, where they would collect the bones, then they transfer the bones to the cemetery. So the Shulchan Aruch actually talks about Likud Atzamos. What is Likud Atzamos? That's what Likud Atzamos is. Likud Atzamos is actually gathering the bones from a temporary burial in one of the kuchin and transferring them to more permanent burial for the kever avos. Yes?
Based on the legislative response of waiting 3 days, is there ever a case that even after 3 days there was a concern maybe the body was still, was the person would get back?
So the question is, where does the 3 days come from? So 3 days comes from either rigor mortis, which is the body becomes stiff, which is a reflection of the fact that the body has been dead, or gangrene. Gangrene is the desiccation or infection of the tissue due to loss of oxygenation to the tissue. So you see, actually, if you watch any of these crime scene investigation shows, you know, the coroner looks at the body and they can tell you an approximate time of death. So the reason they can tell you an approximate time of death is by looking at the color of the skin, because the skin changes color as the blood begins to decompose, and by the rigor mortis and by the onset of gangrene and a whole host of things, depending on the environment also. Yes?
Would this be a good compromise to put in between until 3 days pass, put in the coffin and then take them in after 3 days and do the regular burial?
Excellent question. So they didn't want to make any compromises, halachic compromises, but I assume had they been forced to make a compromise, this wouldn't have been a bad compromise. Apropos your question, there was a concern, and we're not going to discuss it in this discussion, but as part of medical training, anatomical dissection was really introduced in the 1500s, early 1600s, and for hundreds of years, there was a tremendous demand in medical schools across the world for dissection of bodies, but bodies weren't being provided. So how did they get bodies? Anyone know how they provided bodies for medical schools in the Middle Ages and the Renaissance?
Didn't they steal them?
They stole them from graves. They stole them from graves. Which graves were the preferred graves, fascinatingly? Which cemeteries did they go to steal bodies? They went to Jewish cemeteries. Why did they go to Jewish cemeteries?
Bodies were better preserved.
I'm sorry?
They buried right away.
Exactly. Because the Jews, as opposed to the Goyim, who would keep the bodies above ground for a wake. By the way, part of the reason why a wake evolved is precisely for this reason. To keep the body above ground, to make sure that the person wasn't alive still. And that's part of the reason cremation evolved also, because of the finality of death with cremation, as opposed to being buried where you could possibly wake up alive. Now, being burned alive, what's worse, being burned alive or waking up alive. But either way, it eliminates that ultimate fear of waking up. So there is some poskim. There was one posik of Shachna in Cincinnati, where there was tremendous amount of grave robbing in Cincinnati, and he was asked to Shiloh if they could do a temporary burial in these kuchim above ground until the semester, the anatomy semester, was over, and then they could rebury. And he actually paskined that they could do that temporary burial. So maybe it's not ideal, but they did. By the way, I don't know if you guys have been following this, but in Eretz Yisrael, there's not enough ground for burying people who pass away in Eretz Yisrael. So they're coming up with all these creative ways for regular cemeteries. So flat burial in the ground, you know, 6 feet under, is not an option so much anymore in Eretz Yisrael. They simply don't have the land. So they're actually building down into the ground, and they're building towers up to the sky where you can have like 20, 30 levels, and they're struggling with this issue, how to make it a halachically viable alternative. So they're literally having like shoots that go straight up, you know, from the ground, carrying ufor all the way contiguously to wherever the mace is, and have some continuity of ufor, so the mace can be buried in ufor, but still be buried 20 amos or 20 levels above the ground. Yes?
How does that work from a sanitary perspective? Isn't that the whole point of 6 feet under? Is that there's some form of, like, you can't, whatever decomposition, whatever disease comes from that,
So that's a good question. Does it affect disease? So this is, but the halachic literature discusses this too. In times of plague, there were shilas about burying people outside a Jewish cemetery if they could exhume them and return them to the cemetery. So in times of cholera, for example, times of the Chasam Sofer has a tshuva on this. Times of cholera, they didn't bury people in the cemeteries because of the concern for contagion. And by the way, in the 21st century, one of the ways that Ebola, you guys, I don't know if you heard of the disease Ebola, you guys know about Ebola? So I know about Ebola because I had to train to treat patients with Ebola because I work in an Ebola center. So I had to put on the whole hazmat gear for Ebola. But Ebola was transmitted to a lot of people when because they left the bodies above ground or they buried them relatively superficially, and it was able to transmit the Ebola even after death. So it was a major mechanism of transmission. So once they realized this, they required cremation for all those Ebola patients to prevent the disease transmission. So that's interesting, halachic shiloh about cremating in order to prevent disease transmission. Yeah.
Maybe we should just try to keep the question
minimal. Yeah, thanks. Sorry about that. I'm going to get a little. This is Moses. This is a physician who just wrote a book supporting delaying burial, and in the cover of his book, this is actually Moses Mendelssohn's tombstone, and this is somebody who is still alive, who is buried, who's trying to get out of his grave. He obviously supported waiting the 3 days, which most of the Gedolia Poskim did not. So the Shiloh came to the Chasam Sofer at that time. Why is this important? Because this very tshuva that came to the Chasam Sofer is one of the major tshuvas which is used in discussion today about the definition of death. And the Shiloh to him was as follows. Shiloh to him was... So, by the way, it's this interesting historical tangent which people talk about. Sam Sofer usually says who he writes the tshuva to, who he received the tshuva from. So here he wrote Zeis Ra'anan Yefei Pritoar Karashimo Kvod Marenu Harav Ploni Av Bezdin Rosh Masifta Dekil Kadosha Ploni. So he wrote this tshuva, but he didn't mention the individual's name. Why didn't he mention the individual's name? Because he was pretty forceful in his response. And not very covetic in his response to the Shiloh of this Shoel. The irony is that the Shoel was the Maritz Chayis. The Maritz Chayis was so proud of the fact that the Chasam Sofer responded, he published the whole tshuva in his own sefer. But the Maritz Chayis made a strong case, you should wait the 3 days. And the Chasam Sofer said absolutely not. And the question is, why did he say absolutely not? And what was the context of the Shiloh to appreciate the evolution of Halacha? It was precipitated by the fact that they asked a Kohen to go and check on the body after someone had a preliminary diagnosis of death. And we said they waited 3 days for burial. So they waited 3 days, but a doctor had to check every day. So one of the doctors was a Kohen. Now, if you're a Kohen, we can tell you that's another shear, a Kohen treating living patients, or a Kohen who treats someone who's a goseis who might possibly die. Those are fascinating halachic shailos. Kohen studying anatomy, where there's a goof mace, you know, if it's a Jew or non-Jewish, all those kinds of issues. But in this case, the patient that he's going to see is most likely dead. And he's really only going to confirm death. So can a Kohen go into an ohel where there's a patient who's already perceived to be dead? That's what precipitated the Shiloh, because they have to check for 3 days whether these people were alive or dead. And Chasam Sofer, and I think we'll talk about it more, and hopefully we'll have the sources in the... latter section as we move forward. But the Chasam Sofer said that we have a Mesorah about how death is defined. And we have been acting on this Mesorah for 1,000 years. And we're not going to change our Mesorah based on what these physicians say. And the question that this opens up, which is a question which really pervades all discussions of the interrelationship between medicine and halacha, is the acceptance of medical or scientific information into the halachic discourse, into the halachic literature. So does Beis Din accept scientific information? So here you have a halacha psuka for 1,000 years. All of a sudden, a couple of physicians get together and they say, you know, you really got to keep somebody above ground, which is Isser Daraisa of Halanas Ameis and possibly Nibel Ameis. So do we accept the medical, I'll get to your question in a second, do we accept that medical information? If so, when? So today you got a DNA sample from someone who tragically was found at the World Trade Center after the collapse of the buildings, and you bring it into Beis Din, you say, here I have a DNA sample, this is proof that the person's dead, you can sit Shiva, and his wife can remarry based on this DNA sample, yes or no? So how do you incorporate, you know, this person says that this son that I thought was mine has DNA which is different than mine, so clearly this child is a mamzer. Does the fact that science says that this person is a mamzer, does halacha accept that fact? And the answer is, not always. It depends on each particular case, yes?
Can you The Chasam Sofer's claim was from the fact that Torah and Halacha requires us to bury on the day of. His claim is that since the Torah tells us we have to bury on the day that someone dies, it must be that the Torah...
I don't know if he had that circular logic that it must be, but he said we have Mesorah, how about death is defined. The way the Chevra Kadisha has been determining how to decide that someone is dead shouldn't be any different today than it was 100 years ago, 1,000 years ago. It's not like science changed. It's not like there were new technologies that keep somebody alive. The technology didn't change. Someone just had a chashash that all these people that have been diagnosed dead, so you have to think about it in retrospect, so that means that, you know, thousands of people over the centuries could have potentially been buried alive. So if that's the case, so he's saying if they weren't choshesh for that then, so we're not going to be choshesh for it now.
Let's just keep it moving.
Yeah, keep it moving. So let's move into the modern iteration of this discussion about the definition of death. And that's the concept of brain death, and what in fact brain death is. So this entire discussion started in 1968 with an article in the Journal of the American Medical Association, JAMA. And the first article was called A Definition of Irreversible Coma. And here's why these things evolved. Now, I asked you, you know, if you're a Hatzalah member and you come to a house and there's a patient who's Rachman Litzel and you're concerned that they might be dead, how do you determine if they're dead or not? So 100 years ago, if you came to someone's house and they had, God forbid, sustained a heart attack, right? So the heart would stop beating, there'd be no flow to the brain would stop functioning, the patient would stop breathing. This would all transpire within a few moments' time. And the converse was also true. If a person had a stroke or massive bleed in the brain, the brain would stop breathing. The brain is the control center for breathing. There would be no breathing. If there's no breathing, there's no air being delivered to the heart. There's no oxygen, and the heart would stop pumping, and the person would be declared dead within a few minutes' time. When did this all change? This all changed with the advent of one particular medical intervention. That intervention is the respirator, or the life. Many synonyms for the respirator, respirator, ventilator. What is respirator, ventilator? So let me give it in the following context. Let's say there's tragically an accident, a motorcycle accident, and a person sustains massive head trauma, and the rest of his body's fine. Now that person, if left untouched, there would be bleeding in the brain would expand. There'd be no spontaneous respiration, the heart would stop functioning, all within a few moments. But not in the 21st century, because EMS, or Hatzalah, gets there within a few minutes, before the heart stops beating, and they put the person on a respirator. What does that mean? They take literally a plastic tube, put it directly into the person's throat, down into the trachea, and connect that to a machine which delivers oxygen. So then, oxygen is being delivered. What this has created is this created for the first time in history a dissociation between the function of the brain and the function of the heart. So it is possible that even when this person has this tube into their lungs, the brain could continue to decompose. The brain could continue to bleed. The brain could literally herniate, is the term, which push down into the lower part of the skull, lose all its control centers, lose its ability to control breathing, lose all forms of consciousness. But as long as you have a tube delivering oxygen to the lungs, there is oxygen being supplied to the heart, and the heart can continue to beat, and the patient can maintain a blood pressure and look, for all intents and purposes, like they're completely alive. So that's how things have evolved in the 20th and 21st century. Given this realization that you can have a patient who has no brain function, and by the way, the question was, they have no brain function, but will they ever regain brain function? Let's say they develop this problem. Maybe if you put them on a respirator, after a week, a month, you know, maybe they'll get better and return. So this is what this study was. This study was to identify this particular scenario of somebody who has a problem with their brain, which causes irreversible cessation of brain function, and the brain function including the cortex of the brain, which is the big cauliflower-looking part of your brain, which is responsible for consciousness, and the brain stem, which sits at the base of your head, which controls all these vegetative functions like breathing. So in order to determine death, they said there has to be unreceptivity and unresponsivity, which means the person can't respond to you, they won't open their eyes, they won't respond to any type of interaction. No movements, you know, he says determination of death, one of the things, movements, no movements. No breathing. No breathing means no spontaneous breathing. This is a key factor in the definition of brain death. No reflexes, because reflexes are governed by the brain stem. And a flat electroencephalogram. That's actually been changed, but the electroencephalogram actually checks the cortex of the brain. That's the EEG, which you guys may have seen. Now, that was back in the 1960s. Just to fast forward into the 21st century, did that definition remain? Has that definition been challenged? So this was an article from JAMA, revisiting that article. In 2009, says, coma as a clinical state has ancient roots, but the identification and precise codification of specific clinical neurological criteria for brain death, causal of irreversible coma, was first published in 1968. The criteria for brain death enumerated in this article have surely held up during the past 40 years. And they review 40 years of literature. And this is from 2010. Determining brain death in adults, also the same thing. What they published here, which was our issue, is reversibility. So we said, if someone who's diagnosed with this unique condition called brain death, how many patients of this particular definition will get up and leave the hospital? Right? So they wrote here, in adults, there are no published reports of recovery of neurological function after a diagnosis of brain death based on proper neurological criteria. None. So it's not as if there's 5 case reports, 10 case reports. There's not one single case report in the medical literature of somebody who was properly diagnosed with brain death and then returned to a state of consciousness. Now keep in mind that there are lots of reports of people, even with cardiac death, being misdiagnosed. So you'll often hear, like, they take a patient to the morgue and all of a sudden the patient, like, sits up. Now, so EMS can misdiagnose death. And by the way, we talked about this concern of the 3-day burial. The concern for misdiagnosis of death is as old as death itself. That concern still applies to some extent today, but obviously we have much more sophisticated technology to be able to make that determination. Now, just because it is completely irreversible and the person will never resume consciousness, that doesn't necessarily mean that halacha would accept it as a viable definition of death. There has been a halachic definition of death for centuries. Does this new definition change from a halachic perspective? Would halacha accept this new and alternate definition? You guys have any questions about... Yes?
What would be the halachic definition?
So that's exactly what we're going to discuss. We're going to say what halacha would say. And this, just for your interest, if you get the slideshow, these are ways to actually determine at the bedside that a person is brain dead or not. And in the emergency room, we actually do these tests to determine if a patient is clinically brain dead or not. This one is important for the halachic literature, so I'll mention this. Yes?
Is there ever a case where somebody can be halachically dead but will be walking around?
No, by definition, no. So death by definition is irreversible. Death by definition is somebody who has... And we'll see, that's what the post-can talk about. That's what the post-can talk about. And then we'll see the criteria that the post-can mentioned. So the determination of apnea, one of the key determinants of brain death is the fact that a person has no spontaneous respirations. He is not breathing whatsoever. That's important medically, and it's important halakhically, as we'll see in a moment. How do you determine that medically? So these people are all connected to a respirator. So if you take them off the respirator, they're going to have no oxygen. Their heart's going to stop beating. You're going to kill them. So how can you determine if a person stops breathing? So there's a test called the apnea test where the following is done. To prevent a person from dying from low oxygen, you actually float a little catheter, plastic tube, down into the trachea, and you deliver 100% oxygen into the lungs. then you disconnect the respirator while the person is receiving oxygen, saturating the lungs, and you observe to see if there's any spontaneous breathing. Because by definition, if your brain stem is not working, you cannot be breathing. So if a person goes like this, and you're standing at the bedside, that means that the patient's not brain dead. It means the patient's still alive. And we have to do this for a certain number of minutes, and we have to take a blood test to see if the carbon dioxide rises, etc. Now, there are other ways to determine whether, in fact, the brain is still functioning, and those include imaging studies. Brain imaging. Here, you asked me if a person could be alive. So here, it's a doctor standing at the bedside. He said, we've given you a brain scan, and we can't find anything. So this is hopefully not too difficult for you guys to see. This is a normal carotid angiography, which means injection into the carotid artery, and you see the carotid artery going off into the blood vessels of the head. This is a brain dead patient with the same injection. Why is there no blood flow in the brain? Because with brain death, the brain begins to swell and compress inside the skull. The skull doesn't expand. It prevents the brain from expanding. So if there's swelling in the brain, it basically compresses all the blood vessels, so there's no blood flow above the base of the brain. This is also a little difficult to see, but I hope you guys can see this one. This is a normal patient. This is a brain dead patient. Got that? You guys okay with that?
That swelling in the brain would also be what we call a stroke, or that's something different?
So the pathology of a stroke is the blockage of one blood vessel. There can be secondary swelling from trauma, from a stroke, from a brain cancer.
That's a secondary thing.
And then usually that is a focal swelling, a swelling in one specific area of the brain. Brain death is diffuse swelling of the entire brain, which then compresses and forces the brain down into the base of the skull. There's a little hole at the base of the skull called the foramen magnum. And if the brain begins to swell and push into that area, that's the cause of imminent death. Yes.
The PET works by measuring electrical signals or oxygen.
I don't know the exact mechanics of what the PET scan measures.
It's different than the previous. I mean, it's not just a different way of showing a person that doesn't have blood flow.
Right. The objective is to show biological activity within the brain. So this shows biological activity. This is a mechanical display. This just shows you that there's no blood flow in the brain. It doesn't tell you the function of the brain. The PET scan shows actual glucose uptake of the cells, showing that there's biological function of the cells within the brain. So this is a very important aspect from a halachic perspective, and that is there are criteria that neurologists have decided, and there are many neurological associations that have come up with criteria for the definition of brain death, but there is no uniform definition between institutions. There's no universally accepted standard and no one universally and consistently applied algorithm for the determination. So cardiac death is very easily determined. You know, my practice is emergency medicine. I can tell you when the heart stops. And if I want to verify it, I'll take an ultrasound and I'll put it on the chest, and I'll show myself and I'll show the family that the heart is simply not beating. You don't really need to be a rocket scientist to realize that the patient has died if the heart isn't pumping. But here it's much more nuanced, much more sophisticated, much more complicated. It's an assessment of physiological function. It's an assessment of anatomy to some extent. Some hospitals will just do a bedside test, which involves a few of the things that I had slides for before, but won't do any imaging studies. Some hospitals will confirm the diagnosis at point A and 24 hours later. Some will confirm the diagnosis only once. Some will confirm it at point A and then at 3 hours later or 6 hours later. As opposed to cardiac death, which is an event, brain death is a process. It evolves over time. So it's kind of a moving target. So it's a little challenging to make that diagnosis. It can evolve over hours, even days. And it's not as if you can point to one specific time that death has ensued, which you can in cardiac death.
In cardiac death, a person could have cardiac death, and then 3 minutes later, their heart starts pumping again.
So if a person is, so for example, when we perform a cardiac arrest, a person could have complete cardiac standstill, and we inject medications, perform CPR, and the heart could be resuscitated. That is correct.
There was cardiac death, and now he's...
So technically, well, that's an interesting halachic shaila and a conceptual shaila, is that, let's say the heart stopped for 5 minutes, and then, you know, we restart the heart with medical interventions. Does that mean the person was dead for 5 minutes? Or does that mean he was never dead? L'mafreya, he was never dead. So just interesting halachic shailas to think about. So if a kohen walked in the room during those 5 minutes, is a kohen tummy? And if his wife wanted to remarry during those 5 minutes, could his wife remarry during those 5 minutes? So we generally believe that death, by definition, is irreversible. What makes it fascinating historically is that at point A, when this person's heart stopped, if he would have been living 200 years ago, he would have been halachically dead, because there would have been no physiological way to return the heart to its function. But today, we could return the heart to its function. By the way, this is a halacha lemaisa for organ transplantation, and ponder this question. I hope I'll explain it properly for you to appreciate the complexity. Organ donation, which is the major issue here of definition of death, as we'll talk about in a moment, is performed on patients. The hearts are harvested primarily from patients who are in this diagnosis of brain death. And let me actually spend 2 minutes on this now, so I can clarify this as we move to the halachic analysis. What was the impetus for the scientists declaring brain death? So one is the following. You have somebody who's sitting in an intensive care unit, taking up a tremendous amount of staff, tremendous amount of finances, has zero prognosis. There is no chance this person's ever going to wake up. So the medical community said, why do we need to waste resources on someone who has no consciousness, will never regain consciousness? Why don't we declare them dead? That was one motivation to do it. So to clear the ICUs of people who literally would never return function. What's the other issue? The other issue is transplanting human organs from one person to another. If a person's heart stops, in the classic case of death, which is a person's heart stops, can you use that person's organs for transplant? So the answer is, interestingly, in theory, yes, but once a person's heart stops, the organ starts to decompose because there's no blood flow to the organs. So if a person's heart stops at home or in the street, by the time he or she comes to the hospital, the organs are not usable. So it's almost impractical to harvest organs from a patient whose heart stops. Just give me 1 second to finish the thought. So in this scenario, with this new definition of brain death, you have patients who are hooked up to respirators, have oxygen and blood flowing through their entire bodies, but just the brain is completely non-functioning. If we now diagnose these people as dead, we can potentially harvest their organs and transplant them to people who need organs. And that concept, once the medical world accepted this, organ donation skyrocketed. Because these people who were diagnosed with this particular diagnosis of brain death now could serve as organ donors, and the organs were viable. And they could be harvested whenever the surgeon came to perform the harvest, because they could still be hooked up to the respirators, still be hooked up to the IVs, until the surgeons came to perform the harvest. Do you guys understand that? It's a very, very important distinction. So that was one of the major changes with this new evolution of brain death. And some people argued that the only reason the medical community created this brain death definition were for these two reasons: to get people out of the ICUs and stop and cut costs, and to facilitate transplantation. But not that it's a real definition of death. And some people argued, no, it's not true. These people who have a definition of brain death, almost invariably their heart stops within a few days' time. None of them, not a single one of them, ever returns to consciousness. So it is a valid definition of death.
Obviously, the question remains is who's the one who determines, who defines life and death? Is it a team of doctors at Harvard?
Correct. So the religious world, by the way, not only including the Jewish community, but the non-Jewish community, the other religious religions, all told the physicians, you guys can make a medical assessment. You can tell me that, in fact, this patient at the bedside, their brain has died. You can't tell me that this defines the death of the human being. That's my determination. I look at my religious tradition, my religious literature, to make the determination whether, in fact, this patient is halachically, in our context, is halachically dead or is not halachically dead. And that's the... get to the halachics. And that's what we're going to discuss for the rest. Yes? Okay, so here you are. You're a posek now in the late 20th century. What makoros are you going to turn to answer this question? Doctors say, we now determine that this new definition is an equivalent definition of death. We are going to either transplant their organs or disconnect them from the machine, write the death certificate, and bury them right away. So the posek has to answer, you know, is this person halachically dead or not? And there's obviously major halachic nafkaminas. You know, is it a question of halanas ames and nivel ames, and you have to disconnect the respirator and bury the patient immediately? Or maybe brain death is not halachic death at all, and such a person is 100% halachically alive. You have to keep performing all the maneuvers to resuscitate that patient or to keep that patient alive. Is a kohen matame when a kohen walks in the room? Is a kohen not matame? Can the woman's wife remarry? Can the woman's wife not remarry? So major, major halachic ramifications. So as I said, it's challenging to find makoros which are relevant. So here's a number of the makoros. There's only, and here's one of the fascinating things, there's only a handful of makoros, literally a handful of makoros that the post can turn to. And what's most extraordinary is that with these handful of makoros have evolved literally diametrically opposed approaches to the acceptance or rejection of the definition of death. But these are the makoros themselves. You guys can study them yourselves and see how you would analyze them. This is one of the classic ones. This is the Gemara Yoma. Misha Nafal of Mapolis, Tanu Rabbanan. So the context here is a Shabbos. Shabbos, a building collapsed. It's a Rishus HaRabim. You can't, you know, obviously you have a Chiyuv of Pikuach Nefesh to try and be matzil all these people. But there's also an Isser of Hotzab and Muktzah by taking these stones and moving them in a Rishus HaRabim. So you're allowed to do it to save the individual. But how do you know if they're alive or dead? As soon as you know that this person is dead, then you no longer have a license to be Mechal Shabbos to save them. So the Gemara says, how do you know they're dead? Ad heichanu bodek, how far do you check? If a guy's buried under the rubble, how far do you check? Ad chotmo. So one man d'amar says you check until the nostrils, v'yesh omrim ad libo. And some say you check until the heart. And there's different girsa ad taburo, until the navel. And what's the maskan of the Gemara? Amara Papa, machlokes mimata lamala. Rabbi Papa said the machlokes is if you discover the body feet first, then they're cholek, do you check until the nose or do you check until the heart? Now, just very simply, if you're checking until the nose, what are you checking for?
Breathing.
Checking for breathing, right? What did they do in the old days? They put a feather, they put a mirror, right? Ad libo, what are you checking for? Assumedly, you're checking for the heartbeat. Although, the chest is not the ideal place to check for a pulse. Now, in the times of the Gemara, they weren't checking for pulse in contemporary medicine. The concept of checking for pulse is a much, much later medical development. But the assumption is you're checking for heart function. So Papa says that there's no machlokas if you find the person head first. If you find the person mimala lamata, kaven de bodaklei ad chotmo, once you reach the nostrils, Shuv eino tzarech. You do not need to continue. So if you reach the nostrils and there's no respiration, there's no evidence of breathing, the person is dead. You have no license to be Mechal Shabbos anymore. Dichsiv, and here's the fascinating thing, Dichsiv mentions a pasuk. Kol asher nishmas ruach chaim be'apov. Nishmas ruach chaim, the soul of life is in the nostrils, is in the nares. So it's interesting that a pasuk is mentioned, and for something to ponder, is the pasuk just a siyua, a nice drasha, or is the pasuk mean we have a mesora misinai, how death is to be defined? And that itself, by the way, is a huge, huge fork in the road about how to analyze this particular sugya and all other medical sugyas. Is there a mesora from Har Sinai through Chazal about how medicine or halachas to be defined in medical areas? Or do the poskim of every generation to some extent rely on what the doctors of that generation share with them in terms of paskening and halacha? Now this Gemara, some people say, if you Rashi says, for example, ad heifanu bodek, im domel ameis she'eno meziz evarov. If you see a guy, obviously, you asked if the person is moving, is he still alive? So Rashi says a prerequisite for the definition of death is the guy can't be moving. If he's walking around, he ain't dead. So he says, im domel ameis she'eno meziz evarov. If he looks like he's dead and he's not moving. So some people turn to this and say that a person who's brain dead is meziz evarov. His heart is beating. He's got a blood pressure. How could you call that person dead? Only someone who is eino meziz evarov, meaning completely no movement, including the heart. And there are others who would counter and look at this in the Gemara and say, kevan de bodak le ad chotmo. What's the determination if you reach the nostrils? They would say it's the respiration. It's the breathing that's the determinant. And to translate that into modern definition, what controls your breathing? The brain. And if I determine that the brain is dead, then I have a very valid proof that there is no breathing. Based on this Gemara, if there's no breathing, the person's halachically dead. So we could literally spend an hour or two just analyzing every sentence of these Gemaras. But I just want to share with you some of these discussions. Now, this is how the Gemara is paskin, by the way. So the Rambam says, "Badku ad chotmo v'lo motzu bo neshama, manichin oso sham shekvar meis." Right? And the Shulchan Aruch also. Now the interesting thing, again, sort of keeping two perspectives as we go through all these different makaros. So those who accept brain death and say that the Gemara in Yoma paskins respiration, and if there's no respiration, the person's dead, they say, well, the Rambam only mentions respiration, mentions neshama. Shulchan Aruch likewise. Lo hirgishu b'chot mo chius. You only look at the respiration. They say they're continuing to paskin that it's only respiration which is the determinant, and if there's no respiration, i.e., the person is brain dead, there is no spontaneous respiration, the person is halachically dead. The other poskim say, no, that's not true at all. That really, when the Gemara said, bod kule ad chotmo, when you're checking the nostrils are a reflection that the heart is beating or not. It's not a definition in and of itself. It's simply a reflection that the heart is not beating. And when you're checking the nostrils, it's not a simen hamisa, but rather a reflection that misa has existed.
It's not a simen hamisa, it's a simen.
I'm sorry?
You say it again, it's not a simas hamisa, it's a simen hamisa.
It's not
that the breath is...
Breath isn't the definition.
Rather, it's just reflection.
It's a reflection, right.
Can you say that there's two sides again?
Yeah, sure. So the interpretation of this Gemara is as follows. When it says, came into bud kulei ad chot moshuvei no tzarech, there's two ways to look at that fact. The fact is, if you don't have respiration, if you don't feel respiration in the nose, the person's halachically dead. The question is why? According to some poskim, the answer is that the breathing defines death. And if there's no breathing, definitionally the person is dead. And that breathing alone, in and of itself, is the determinant of death.
That's the
siva. I don't want to confuse siva and siva. So
that's the siva. You're breathing, you're alive. You're not breathing, that's the siva of life, yes. You're not alive.
I don't want to confuse everybody of it, because I might say that's the simon.
Okay, fine.
That's the simon, because that defines it. That's the simon. So but the other postman would say that's not true, that the reason why you're checking the nostrils is because the nostrils is an effective way of assessing the heart function. And since I clearly know from the nostrils that the heart is not beating, therefore the person's dead.
Explain that last point. How could you tell from...
So their contention is that physiologically, if a person's heart is beating, then they would be creating respiration, which would be felt in the nostrils. Now, we could argue whether physiologically today in the 21st century that would necessarily be the case, but that's not necessarily where I want to go. I just want to say in terms of the understanding of the
heart is beating...
breaths. Right.
And it's possible that there's breath.
Correct.
So the fact that you see a breath in the nose, that shows you that, oh, he's alive because his heart is beating.
Correct.
Not
correct.
That the breath is showing you that he's alive, but that...
The breath is not relevant. I don't care whether he's breathing or not. I care if his heart's beating, and I know through the breath
that his heart is,
that his heart is beating.
And therefore, it's really the heartbeat that makes him alive.
Correct, correct. Correct.
Machine,
and if you flip it, and I'll answer both your questions. If you flip it, so then why is there a machlokas mimata lamala? Right? That's what you're going to ask me. So if you flip it, so the answer, reason why there's a machlokas is because sometimes if the chest wall has been crushed, you may not pick up the heartbeat from assessment of the libo. You might have to wait till the chotmo in order to get an effective assessment that cardiac function is still present. Did I explain that?
Say it again. Yeah. It's an important point.
Yeah, it's an important point. So why is there machlokas mimata lamala? The reason there's machlokas mimata lamala is because if you discover, you start at the feet and you get to the chest, and there's no heartbeat, so according to some, you could stop right there. According to others, you have to continue to the nostrils, because the nostrils are a better assessment of cardiac function. Not that the nostrils or the breathing is the determinant. They're a more effective assessment of cardiac function, yes.
According to this perspective, why, how do they get that from the Gemara? I mean, even if you assume that the Pasuk itself isn't a Makor, it's more of a Sinasmach or whatnot, it's clearly phrased as there being Ruach Chaim in the person, not that there is a specific function.
So answer, short answer is, from Rashi and the other Rishonim. So I'm actually going to move ahead because I want to just plow through some of the other stuff. I'm happy. Unfortunately, I can't stick around because I have to go straight to the hospital now. But this is a serious offer. If anybody who has questions that we're not able to answer today, Rabbi Orlian has my email. Just shoot me an email. I'm happy to pick up the discussion afterwards. Now, there is another major source from the Mishnah. And it's unclear if this source is a parallel analysis or integrated with the Gemara Yoma. I'm going to contend that it's a separate parallel source assessing the definition of death. The Gemara in Ohalos, which talks about tuma issues, says Adam einu matame ad shetetze nafsho. How do you know when a person is matame? Now, matame is an alternate definition for death. It's death that creates tuma. So a person's matame. You like the like this one? Mm-hmm. So it's death which creates tuma. And here it says, sometimes the Hebrew gets confused. If they are physically decapitated, literally their heads are chopped off, even though the body is moving, they are metame. Which means that physical decapitation creates misa. Okay? There's machlokas, by the way, it says the chen behem v'chai is machlokas, whether the statement refers only to behem v'chai or whether it refers to Adam. We'll assume for our discussion now that it refers to Adam. So some argue, and Rabbi Tendler, actually, I met in the elevator on the way to this lecture, one of the gaonim who is at the forefront of this debate, and by the way, you have here Rabbi Bleich and Rabbi Tendler, as part of my edutainment when I was your age. We used to go to debates between Rabbi Bleich and Rabbi Tendler on this topic, on the definition of death. It was wild. It was crazy how they would go at it for hours. It was amazing. So Rabbi Tendler's contention was the following. If you chop off the head of a person, it's halachic misa. If you have someone who's brain dead, there is admittedly not anatomical decapitation, but there is physiological decapitation, which means physiologically, the control center is not being able to dictate to the goof below, and that has been disconnected. Now, some have argued, from a contemporary medical perspective, that that's not really true. That these patients who are brain dead do have some physiological connection. True, 98% of the connection is gone. But there's still some connection, there's still some neurotransmitters that are getting through from the brain. So, for example, the hypothalamus controls temperature of the body. So if your body is maintaining a temperature of 98.6 degrees, it must mean that some neurotransmitters from the brain are getting through to the rest of the body, and there really isn't a physiological decapitation. That was one of the debates. Other sources which have been mentioned. This Chacham Tzvi, famous tshuva. Chacham Tzvi lived in the 1600s. And the shiloh that was asked to him is a woman found a chicken. And in those days, they used to shech their own chickens, and they used to kasher their own chickens. And she said, she looked at the chicken, she's just about to eat the chicken, and she realizes, or she's just about to prepare the chicken, she realizes the chicken has no heart. Heartless chicken. So she asked the Chacham Tzvi, is this a kosher chicken or not? So he uses this as an opportunity to talk about the anatomy of the heart, the physiology of the heart, and the importance of the heart. And it's, the whole sugya is nital alev, if the heart was disconnected. And he actually says that there's no way this chicken could have lived until this point if it didn't have a heart. And he says, ad kedei kach, that if two edim come and testify that the chicken was nital halev, he said, you don't believe their edus, because it's impossible for the chicken to have lived without a heart. So the point of this tshuva is, he has many, many pages discussing that the lave is the center of the body, the lave is the center of the nefesh, the lave is key. And people point to this tshuva and say that the lave is of primary importance, so if the lave is still functioning, the person's considered halachically alive. By the way, many of the sources that he quotes, the Ibn Ezra, the Kuzari, the Sadigon, all invoke the same physiology of innate heat that we talked about, that the Ramban was talking about. It was contemporary with a number of these Rishonim. And I'm not going to discuss the debate between him and Yonason Eibershitz. Fascinating discussion. The Chacham Tzvi, by the way, was not familiar with and did not discuss the work of William Harvey, who had preceded him. And William Harvey was the first person to identify the circulation of the blood. So he was not yet familiar. I mean, he followed William Harvey. He could have known about it, but the information wasn't so easily disseminated as it is today, you know, with Twitter or an email. So he was not familiar with that. The Chasam Sofer, we mentioned in the context of the three-day burial controversy, he is also mentioned in this debate. And he is discussed, both sides, both support and reject brain death, turn to the Chasam Sofer. And they read different phrases of the Chasam Sofer. So here the Chasam Sofer says, Afilu hachi, kishepaska nishma so, shuv ein mechalim Shabbos. Once his breathing stops, by the way, it's interesting that neshama and nishima, the same root, by the way, soul, breath, the same Hebrew shorish. We have a Mesorah, but this is how we define death. So he said, I don't care what you doctors say, it's all meaningless to me. This is our Mesorah about how we define death. And what does he say there? He only mentions the breathing. But others say, no. Later on in the tshuva, he says, "Aval kol she'achar she'mutol ke'even domein, ve'ein bo shum defika." That if the person is looking dead with no movement, ve'ein shum defika. What's defika? Pulse or heartbeat. V'machar kach botel hanishima. And only after there's no heartbeat, if he stops breathing, then and only then is he determined dead. Now, my question on this is the following. There is no Havamina that anybody writing at the time of the Chasam Sofer is going to assume that a person who has a heartbeat is dead. There's no Havamina. It's not a context. It's not a frame of reference. It's not a case. The kasha we have to ask is not to try and extrapolate from the Chasam Sofer's words about defika or the words about the nishima. Shaila we have to ask is if the Chasam Sofer were alive today, looking at a brain-dead patient, how would he paskin? And that's not so easily answered. So to go and kvetch a word here, a word there, there's no havamina that a person's still at a heartbeat and you're thinking the guy is dead. It's not your wildest imagination. That's what makes these cases so challenging for the postgame today, that sometimes there's genuinely no precedent. And it's very challenging. Yes?
Is
Actually, no, I'm going to hold. I'm going to hold. I apologize because I have to. Can't leave late because I got to be at. Got to be working time. These are just a few of the books entirely on brain death. So you have 1, 2, 3. This is already in 2 editions. 4, 5 works entirely. There's no other parallel. Actually, on fertility, the 2 ones that you have, Rabbi Dr. Levine, there's a lot of works on fertility. There's a lot of works on the definition of death. What are the major players? Who are the major players in the landscape today? So you have the great post-Yunari Yeshiva. You have Rabbi Tendler in conjunction with Moshe Feinstein and Rabbi Bleich, and we'll just go through these. Again, I'm going to share the PowerPoint with Rabbi Orlean, so you don't have to worry about seeing what I'm doing now. You can keep it and use it at a later time. So the Shita Rishona, Shita Zu mitbaseset al divrei Chasam Sofer v'Agon Rav Moshe Feinstein, uparshanu tam l'sugyas haGemara b'yoma, l'da'atam hafsakas hanishima be'ofen bilti hafich mehaveat ha'siman ha'ilchati ha'ikari l'kviat mavet. Bottom line, according to those interpreting the Chasam Sofer using the word Nishima, and interpreting the Gemara Yoma, focusing on the respirations, Nishmaso, they claim that the sole determinant of death is irreversible cessation of respiration. If the person cannot breathe on their own. Now, somebody asked me if this person is awake and alert. Now, there's some people who can't breathe on their own, who have disease of their muscles, who are alive, who need to be put on a respirator. There's someone who has a piece of meat stuck in their trachea who can't breathe on his own. Doesn't mean that he's dead. So you have to keep it in context. It has to be in the context of someone who otherwise appears and looks dead and has no spontaneous breathing. How do we determine spontaneous breathing in the 21st century? By the definition of brain function. If there is no brain stem function, the person cannot breathe spontaneously on their own. It is impossible. That's the very definition. But the others argue. So, for example, Rav Waldenberg, and this time he was still alive, and now Zatzal Rosner, they rely on the Chacham Tzvi. Al pia dafka hafsukas beilas haleiv. He has siman ha'ilchati akoveya. I mean, there are other. They would reinterpret the Gemara Yoma. They'd reinterpret these other makaros. But they turn to the Chacham Tzvi that the lave is the primary organ of the body. If the lave is still beating, I don't care what else is going on in the body. The body is still halachically alive. And there's a Shita of Shlomo Zalman. A Shita of Shlomo Zalman I'm actually not going to go into in depth. He's more nuanced. He's sort of an intermediary Shita. He has a different mahalach than some of the other poskim. Rav Moshe, the big debate today is how indeed Rav Moshe paskind. And this is a fascinating thing. I'm not going to go line by line through the Chuvos of Rav Moshe, but just essential that you understand this. Rav Moshe lived in the time right around the determination of brain death. He died really before it became, you know, very accepted, very popular, and the literature had really evolved. According to Rabbi Tendler Shlita, it is very clear, unequivocal, that Rav Moshe Feinstein accepted the brain death criteria as halachic death. Not everybody agrees with that. There's some people who maintain that there's too many internal contradictions in the Shilas and Chuvas of the Igros Moshe, that it's not as unequivocally stated in his Chuvas as one would like, and there's some who maintain that Rav Moshe himself did not accept the brain death criteria. I just wanted to share that fact with you. This is one of those things which will remain ad bias HaMashiach, teku, until we find out what the ultimate truth of that is. It is very challenging. It is very frustrating to look at the existing kisvei ksavim of the Igros Moshe. There are many, many testimonies from people who knew Rav Moshe, talked to Rav Moshe, and there's a site called the Halachic Organ Donor Society where he marshaled actually video testimonies of people that knew Rav Moshe, talked to Rav Moshe, and you can look on that site and decide for yourself. But I think the preponderance of belief is that indeed Rav Moshe did hold the brain death criteria were indeed halachic death. And he held that it was the respiration which was the determinant. A chief rabbin of Eretz Yisrael accepted that brain death criteria a few decades ago, and they reaccepted it again in 2008 and 2009, and that is the psak halacha of the chief rabbin. Rav Schechter Shlita has a completely different mahalach than all these others. He doesn't use the Gemara Yoma, he doesn't use the Mishnah Olos, he doesn't talk about the a little bit of the Chacham Tzvi and the Chassam Sofer. But his mahalach is based on the following, that that circulation is the determinant, and there are three evarim shehaneshama teluya bahem, the heart, the liver, and the brain, and it's a suffix if cessation of circulation to one or all is required to determine death. So again, I'm just mentioning this as his shita, but it's not really in the major discussions of the brain death the debate. It's a very unique shita. Rabbi Bleich is one of those who does not accept the brain death criteria. He's a strong proponent of cardiac death. Cardiac death is what defines halachic death. As you said, Shlomo Zalman had his unique shita, but it did in principle accept the possibility of brain death as being halachic death.
Where in the process does the liver stop in relation to those other organs?
So the liver actually, in modern medicine, liver has nothing to do with the definition of death. Zero. So that's actually a shaila. So if you hold it, if one of the organs alone constitutes death, so then a person in liver failure should be dead. And that person's walking around, people in liver failure. So that's a shaila in Rav Schechter's check. Yes?
Just
not
like reflecting my ignorance, but what would be the difference between being in a coma for like 1 year?
Ah, thank you for mentioning that. That's one of the slides that I skipped, actually. Coma, all coma means is absence of consciousness. And there's a vast spectrum of coma. And the textbook on coma, just on coma, is this thick. So, for example, you ever hear of Terry Schiavo? Mm-hmm. Is that a name that sounds familiar to you? Karen Ann Quinlan, probably a little before your time. You ever hear of someone called a vegetable? Someone's like a vegetable in a respirator? So people who are comatose, or in a so-called persistent vegetative state, can be the case if their cortex is not functioning. So that's the main cauliflower-looking part of the brain. If the cortex of the brain is not functioning, people can be comatose. Now, people can be comatose, but be breathing completely on their own, and be otherwise completely healthy, and can live for decades. But brain death is a very unique a specific neurological definition which includes not only the cortex of the brain, which if non-functioning can create coma, but irreversible coma, which is including the brain stem. And the brain stem includes the ability to breathe and other aspects. So brain death definition includes the brain stem, not just the cortex of the brain. And by the way, when you read, this is one of those very important things in general, as you're reading through halachic literature of a newly developing technology, the understanding of the technology evolves. So you have a posek who's writing like in 1967 when the first article came out from Harvard, and is writing in 1967, that very posek might change his understanding based on the understanding of medicine which evolves. So there are many poskim who confuse the two and thought that the cortex was what determines life and not the stem of the brain. And you might actually find Chubos that mentioned that, but that was the way it was understood at that time and not fully understood. So it's very important to understand the evolution of medicine as you go through different Chubos. Any other questions, thoughts, comments? Yes?
Just can you just review again just like the basic machlokas about the mind? Either we say that the stopping of breathing equals death, in which case you would say that the
focus on one, and then it's
okay.
Easier to figure out the other.
Okay.
Is the definition of life breathing?
Okay.
And if you're breathing, you're alive, and if you're not breathing, you're dead. That's one shita.
Okay.
And that's why it's kol asher nishmas ruach chayim ba'apav. Breathing is the definition. If you're breathing spontaneously, you're alive. If not breathing, you're dead.
That's linked to the heart, or that's linked up?
Independent. And I mean, it happens to be physiologically related. They're all interrelated. But the truth is, the heart could be beating with the respirator that's creating the oxygen, breathing the heart. Heart could beat, I don't care if the heart's beating. As long as the person has no spontaneous breathing, and that's determined by the apnea test, which we alluded to, that person is halakhically dead, even though the heart is beating, even though they have a pulse, even though they have a blood pressure. The other person says, it's the definition is not breathing. The breathing only is a reflection that the heart is still beating. And if the heart is still beating, that's why the person's alive, not because of the breathing alone. So therefore, even if a person is brain dead, and he has no spontaneous breathing, as long as that heart is beating, the person was 100% alive. Now keep in mind that there's some people, and you need to understand this also because you're going to experience this. There's some people that keep in mind that if you don't hold of brain death, the person's halachically alive, you can't harvest their organs to transplant to somebody else. So there's some people that actually, it's chas v'shalom, they actually speak against poskim who hold that brain death is not halachic death, and they think that they're committing a crime by not facilitating organ transplantation. Because if you say brain death is not halachic death, then you can't be an organ donor. But that's not the approach of these gedolim. These gedolim, their approach is that the patient might be halachically alive. They're trying to save their suffic pikuach nefesh for the patient who's alive. You have to realize the ramifications of being and the godless of someone who accepts this psak on their shoulders. If you say that a person who's brain dead is halachically dead, that's literally a life or death psak. Because if you're wrong, then you're committing iritzicha. So you have to realize that the godless of people that accept the brain death definition, but also the godless of people who don't, because they don't believe it. That's the makoris to teach them in that direction. And there are those who say, it's a suffix. I don't know one way, I don't know the other, but since it's a suffix pikuach nefesh, it's suffix ritzicha, I can't paskin against it. I apologize, I have to run, guys.
Thank you very much. I will send you this.
Actually, it's on the desktop here. I dropped it on the desktop. I don't know if I sent it to you.
I might have it. I'll check.
Okay.
If I don't, I'll
okay, great.